Welcome once again to Steve's Speed Shop in association with our good friends at Douglas Loveridge Publications, The Enthusiast's Bookshelf. On this edition of Speed Shop, we'll be asking which was the greatest, and I shall take a deep breath, which was the greatest four-seater European-made performance car of the mid to late 90s, and that discussion does include the iconic Lancia Delta Integrale, so I'd stick around if I were you. And we love American cars, well, some of them, at the Speed Shop. And so when the Stars and Stripes show comes along on the same weekend, the nearest weekend to July the 4th, we always pop along. We'll have a report from there. But first, when most British people decide to visit beautiful Bolton Abbey in North Yorkshire, they do so because of the marvellous landscape and scenery. They take photographs of the delightful ruined abbey and they wonder, if I can paraphrase Wordsworth, as lonely as a cloud, if you could do that with a few thousand other people. But when I went there the other day, it wasn't for sightseeing reasons. I found a paddock full of names from the glory days of British motoring cars with badges like Alvis, Riley and Fraser Nash, but mainly I found little Austin Sevens. And the reason was, it was a car trial. No judge or jury, car trialing. Well, it goes back to the turn of the 20th century. The Land's End trial dates from 1903. And it's a very simple form of motorsport. A course is laid out on a grassy hillside and you attempt to make progress. Four-wheel drive and off-road tyres are banned, which of course make things very tricky, but when I was offered the chance of a drive in a supercharged 1936 Triumph, I jumped at it.
Here we go. We are on the start line. We've disconnected the supercharger, haven't we, Sean?
We have disconnected, so it's no more a supercharger, just a charger.
We're running in the normally aspirated class now.
Reclassified.
Yeah, we've been reclassified. So here we go. So up the hill we go, past marker number one. Plenty of revs, bit of opposite lot there. Past two, on towards three. Oh, bounce. Oh no. Blimey, we're getting some speed up going down this hill. Three. That was all right. Was that better than last time?
Well, you
think we're better? Normally aspirated, or were we better when we had a supercharger?
I think we were a bit better with a supercharger.
Right, a bit more oomph. Three? Right, well, let me just explain where we are. We're in God's country, aren't we, Sean?
We're in Yorkshire.
Yeah. We're in just above the very handsome market town of Skipton in the rolling hills of Yorkshire. What they call Heriot country, isn't it, Sean?
I do believe so, yeah. They like their animals around here.
Well, they're remaking that Old Creatures Great and Small as a movie, so even our American listeners might have some idea of what I'm talking about. Just imagine England's green and pleasant land, the rough sort of hilly bit, and that's where we are with a load of old cars, some of the greatest names in the history of British motoring. There are Austins, there are Rileys, and there's a Triumph here, and I'm just about to get in it and try and drive it round this course, but I have just tried and I think I lasted a grand total of about 10 seconds before I ignominiously ground to a halt and slid back right down the hill in a rather undignified manner. Sean, just explain what's going on here today.
We are, the aim is to drive up the hills off a series of numbers up to about 20, and the higher the number you get, the more difficult it is. Steve got to about three, I think. And I managed to get to 13 in the same car.
So. You told me to put it in first.
No excuses.
This is a handsome... Hold on, there's just... that's surely an Austin 7 special.
It is, yeah.
But this car, the car that we had... That little Austin 7 scampered up there like it was absolutely no problem at all, Sean.
It did very well, yeah, very well.
Tell us a bit about the car that you and I are sharing today.
It's a 1936 Triumph Gloria, so it's a long chassis with a supercharger on it. And what's ideal for these events is a short chassis with no supercharger.
Yeah.
So we've given ourselves two huge penalties before we even started.
There's that young lady in the Riley who just absolutely romped up there. That is really built for this sort of sport,
it's
though,
perfect.
Isn't it?
High ground clearance, plenty of low-end power, good tyres, and a girl that's driving it that's just beat our second driver, he got to 6 and she got to 17, I think.
This is a very traditional form of motorsport, isn't it? I was watching an old Pathé newsreel of this last night, doing a little bit of preparation, and it was from just after the war. And yeah, it was almost all Austin Sevens. And this is really where, if you want to trace the roots of a British success, this is going to sound a bit nuts to people, but I'm going to explain it in just a second, well, with Sean's help. This is where Britain's dominance of Formula One comes from, isn't it? Those Austin Seven specials that people built to do this sort of motorsport after the war.
Yeah, well, if you look here, over half the entry, I think, here today is Austin Sevens, and they don't have to be particularly valuable cars, but the home-built specials...
Noisy,
which seem to do incredibly well.
That's one, as if on cue, a fantastic little Austin Seven, dark red, piloted by a mature couple.
Yes, cable brakes,
skinny little tyres on that thing, Sean, as well. So it'll scamper up there. I reckon the car that you and I are in, the Triumph, would weigh, at a rough estimate, at least 2.5 times what that little Austin Seven
weighs. Well, we weighed that recently on an event and it weighed 1,398 kilos and I bet they're about 500.
So I wasn't so far off, was I? Right, well, we'd better have a go at it. What's car? Look at those three concerned men looking at the engine. We've only done 2 sections. Yeah, I reckon we've brought the most powerful car that's here today, that supercharged Triumph.
Yeah.
And it's rubbish, we've got too much power. Your Chrysler, it romps up there like a mountain goat.
Yeah, well, it's all in the driving.
No, it is.
It's all in the driving. Don't you believe these bouncers who say it's all in the bouncing? It's all in the driving. If you shut your eyes and... Oh, I nearly said a rude word then. shut your eyes and just floor it.
So, how come this... What this Chrysler... The Rileys and the Austins, I can see why they get up there, no problem. Yeah. Lightweight, skinny tyres, you know... That look at that little Austin 7 there, and it probably weighs about as much as an empty crisp packet.
It's cheating, really, isn't it?
But this big bus of yours, I mean, this would have been a luxury car. When was its day?
1929 was its first day.
And is it one of the British-built ones? Because Chrysler made some cars over here, didn't they?
Yeah. Right. Yes, nodding from off-screen right.
Because I noticed the steering wheel's on the right.
Yeah, well spotted. You're all over it, aren't you?
So what about the engine? It must be.
It's got an engine.
It must be torque that got you up that hill.
Yeah, there was a lot of torque coming from back seat. None of it worth repeating.
So is it? I think the secret here now is I've never seen so many women in motor racing.
No,
it's a good thing.
That's why I've got into it recently.
Really? Right. So, okay, let's have some top tips for you. When it comes to car, what do you need? What do you need to be successful in this form of motor racing?
3 bouncers who are up for a bit of a laugh.
3 bouncers?
Yeah.
The bouncers are crucial.
Well, they can be. They can be. Providing they're not going up and down like pistons. They need to be going up and down roughly at the same time.
Right. So synchronised bouncing.
Correct.
Is the trick.
It is really, yeah. There's no good having 3 dead weights.
Tell us a bit about the car. I can't help but notice that you're going very well in it. Just tell us a bit about this car.
It's a 1929 Fraser Nash Super Sports is the model. I've had it for about 7 years. And I've driven it to Bolzano in Italy. I've driven it to Cornwall and back a few times. But I don't often trial it. This is the first time I've tried
it. What's the secret of its success here today? Because I've been in a...
It's a brilliant car.
36 Triumph, which is a brilliant car, but it was absolutely terrible at this particular form of motor racing.
This is chain driven. So on the back axle, you've got 4 big chains, a bit like a motorcycle.
Yes.
4 big motorbike chains, one for each gear. And it's just... So there's no differential. It's a fixed back axle.
It just seems some of these, the smaller cars, the little 7 specials, they fly up.
Oh, they do.
They romp up.
Yeah.
But your progress seems to be would stately.
Slow but stately.
Stately.
Yes. Yeah.
But you get that.
Right. We do all right. Yeah.
So what about the bouncing? Are you?
Oh, I'm new to it all.
Oh, are you new to the bouncing?
Totally new. Yes. It's my first time today.
Seems quite strange to be interviewing 2 women about the bouncing, but the bouncing can be quite vigorous. Have you seen those young lads in the Alvis?
They're
virtually. You think they're rubbish?
Boing.
Yeah, it's all to do with synchronisation because the chap in the Chrysler who's got his wife and his daughters, they are perfectly synchronised. Yeah. And again, he's flying up there.
Yeah.
So, pedal to the metal is what the 7 special people say,
it's
quite different.
More finesse.
Right, well, I'll thank you very much. It's a fantastic motor car.
Did
you change the tyres for this?
The tyres are Longstone tyres. You want good tyres for your car?
Right, well, the Fraser Nash, the chain driven, and I believe that's part of the secret of its success. I can't believe it, we're at a motorsport event and there are two women in the car that's competing, and the marshal who's instructing them is a woman and her assistant is a woman. Remarkable. He said, attempting not to sound like a horrible sexist chauvinist monster. Yeah, it's very low tyre pressures as well in the Fraser Nash. Lovely thing. Sort of a Dutch blue. Incredible patina. The car's got to be the thick end of 100 years old. And here it is competing. The wife knows more than you about your car.
Too bad, she's the mechanic.
Oh, she's the mechanic and you're the driver. Do you not swap? I can't help but notice that most of the cars here that are entered in this event are Austin Sevens. What's the reason for that?
Austin Sevens are very good trials cars, really, that's why.
Well, didn't really trials after the war start with Austin Sevens?
Yeah,
I mean, it's gone on since the birth of the motor car, hasn't it, really?
People have developed onto a lot of other cars, like Model A Fords are very good trials cars as well for bigger cars at the trial. Plus, the parts are available, so if you do break them, the parts are relatively cheap and available.
That thing that I'm in, the Triumph's rubbish. It's way too heavy and it's got miles too much horsepower. What do you actually need for this sport? What's required from a car?
A well-fettled car that's fairly light, I suppose,
yeah.
And good ground clearance.
And which, I mean, in some respects, a lot of people would say that the little 7 looks a bit like a toy car. I mean, look at that Triumph or the thing that's coming down the Riley. It's tiny, it's half the size of those two cars.
Well, it looks a bit like Brum off the children's programme.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I remember that. My kids loved that when they were little. They're
exactly.
All grown up.
It's like a noddy car and Brum.
What about brakes and horsepower and stuff like that?
These are 7 horsepower, aren't they? Because of the Austin 7.
7 horsepower?
Yeah.
Oh, you're not telling me you've only got 7 horsepower and you're romping up there and we can't get up there in that Triumph with supercharged Triumph with God knows how much horsepower.
Well, have a look under the bonnet. There's the original engines in there.
So, do you do this a lot?
We do, yeah. We do all of the vintage sports car trials all over the country, yeah.
Does he ever speak, this fella?
No.
I'll see if he can speak. Are you
not
allowed to? So,
no.
Right, now, I've had a go at this, and I got to 3, just about, on the number 3. I want to try and get to the end
of that.
In that Triumph. I want to get to the end of at least one section. Give me some driving tips.
Well, I'm different to everybody else. I just put my
I can see that.
Because I just put my foot to the floor.
All right, that's it.
I don't, you know, I get told off I shouldn't do, but today I'm taking it a bit easier. I'm not having my foot to the floor.
Oh, I thought you were going to say, you were going to give me the driving tips in forwards, pedal to the metal.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
But it's not my car. What if I break it?
Tough, they can fix it. You can, eh? And if you could have a different, would you rather have a go in that or that?
Well, I don't want to upset my friend, but I think it's one of those rare days in motor racing where I think we've got the most horsepower, supercharged, Lord knows. It's got to be about 6 or 7 times at least, maybe more, the power of this. But it's rubbish. Mm. We brought the wrong car.
It is. Too big. Too much.
Could
power.
I just ask you about these cars, chaps? The Lier. They seem to be quite successful today. I don't even know what they are. Could you tell me what they are?
They're based on a Reliant Rialto, the 850 aluminium engine, and just a lovely little trials car.
It's a great
road car.
Great little engine, that,
yes.
Isn't it? Very torquey, isn't it?
Yeah. Made in India, of course. So.
Right.
Indian engineering in an English car.
But of course, a three-wheel car based on this very much got four wheels.
Oh, yeah.
So what are is the rest of it custom-made? What are the wheels?
Yes.
I was specially made
for the car.
Right. Because they're very tall but very slim.
Yeah, 16-inch motorcycle tyres, so
right.
Very good. Yeah.
Yeah, and not doing so bad today at all? You having a good run? Getting up most things.
We're having difficulties, but it's more driver than car.
We've got a slight misfire on occasion.
You've got a slight misfire, that's your excuse.
It's
and you're sticking
for
to it.
Last night, I think.
How much would one of these things weigh?
Is it £1,000? Just less than £1,000.
And that little
5 foot wide at the front wheel, that's the widest part.
Right.
10 foot long.
So. Right, well, let's see how this fella gets on, eh?
Yeah.
Oh, is that not the same car? Is that not one of these?
Same car, but they're upgrading by putting Suzuki engines in.
Oh, it's got a Suzuki. Is it a motorbike engine in that one?
No, it's
a
3-cylinder car engine.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, he's doing very well. See if you can better that.
Card.
Oh, now we're stuck. And then at the end of each section, you have to hand your card in. And now we're getting some light manual assistance from our friends and colleagues. Thank you. We got our card back. Steve Berry, 28, class 2. Uh-oh. We're not actually in the section now. This is hard.
Across the world, 24 hours a day. This is Fab Radio International.
Welcome back to Steve's Speed Shop with Douglas Loveridge Publications, The Enthusiast's Bookshelf. Now, unlike a lot of Brits here at the Speed Shop, we are huge fans of American cars. We understand that they are made differently for different reasons, and we celebrate and enjoy that. So when the Stars and Stripes show happens every year, well, we are there like a shot. Thousands of cars gather on the weekend closest to Independence Day, but I was drawn to two very different cars. One made in 1970, the Mercury Colony Park, a station wagon, weighing £4,500 with a 7.5-litre V8 engine and delivering about 10 miles to the gallon. It was a sensible, practical family car in 1970. The other, an exquisite McLaughlin Buick, an American car, of course, which isn't actually American. Right, so let me just describe where we are now. We're in a little oasis of 30s and 40s elegance, perhaps even going back as far as the 20s. Which seems quite odd. We're surrounded by, I mean, the next car on from these three cars that I'm in front of now is a sort of gaudy gold Trans Am thing with the honeycomb wheels and a squawking budgie on the bonnet. I mean, I'm not averse to the charm of those cars, but these three cars are very different. Tell us about your car, Ian.
She's a 1934 McLaughlin Buick. It's Canadian, exported from Canada, late 30s. Body was built by Carlton Carriage Company in London.
I know, Ian, can I just stop you? Sorry to butt in straight away, but I'm intrigued by the McLaughlin story because I've come across some old funeral cars in the UK that were McLaughlin Buicks.
Yeah.
Was there a reason that those cars were assembled in Canada rather than in the States? Was it a tax thing? Or?
Yes, it was. Two things, really. McLaughlin were a carriage builder. They built horse and carriages and so on. And then plane going over. And then, obviously, in the early 1900s, they got onto automotives. And they apparently built, according to all the sales blurb, built a better quality Buick than Buicks themselves in the States. And, of course, there's arguments about that. But, yes, one of the reasons they were very successful in the period of the 30s is because Canada being a crown colony, there wasn't any export duty. So you didn't pay export duty on the car, which was, in those days, a lot of money.
Which is why I found McLaughlin Buicks in Liverpool being used as funeral cars, right. In London being used as funeral cars. Very handsome, imposing cars.
That's right.
And the guy that I met in Liverpool said his father bought them so that he would be the funeral director who stood out in Liverpool.
That's
Everybody
right.
else had Daimlers. They had the sort of, you know, the elegant, sedate, respectable cars of the day. So he got these McLaughlin Buicks. They were very distinctive. Nobody knew what they were, and he could charge more.
That's right. And and they were made popular because of Edward VII and Mrs. Simpson. He always had McLaughlin Buicks. And once they had been built for royalty, then obviously it set a standard that other people wanted to emulate.
What would this car have competed with at the time when it was new in? Would it
Cadillacs.
Have been Cadillacs?
Yeah.
And then here in Europe, Rolls-Royce? Would it have been
Bentley's.
That level of car?
Yeah, it would. Yeah. A lot of them were frowned on because they were American and brash, but the engineering of these cars was years and years in front of the British cars. So,
well, go on, what are the features of this car?
Well, knee-action suspension. In the 70s, Ford brought out with the Ford Cortina the revolutionary new knee-action suspension. This has got it in 1934.
Well, Triumph had 5-valve heads in 1922.
Yeah.
And people were still bragging about 4-valve heads in the 1990s.
Yeah,
so there's all sorts of stories like
so
this.
So vacuum brakes, hydraulic suspension. It's a very good ride. It's quite heavy, but a good ride. And a 4.3 litre straight 8 engine.
well, known for their straight eights back in those days.
They were indeed,
weren't they? They really were, and that was one of the great engines of that era.
Was, yeah, they built it, carried on using the same block until about 1955. So it had a hell of a lifespan, obviously through a number of modifications and so on, they tweaked and twiddled it. But that block ran for an awful long time.
And this motor, presumably liberated from grand cars like this, was a big hit with the hot rodders, wasn't it?
Oh,
they
right,
loved
yeah.
this motor.
Yeah.
Put it in a much smaller car and it would go like all hell.
Yeah, yeah.
But does that mean that it's very hard to find a complete car because the hot rodders stole all the engines?
It's a nightmare. This is a Series 50.
Not stole the engines.
Yeah.
They just thought, ooh, we're going to have... Yeah. Those Buick straight eights are awesome.
Yeah.
Let's put them in a much smaller car.
That's right.
And so you turn round now and try and restore the car, and all the hot rodders have got the straight eights.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
They won't give them back.
Yeah. You can still find some engines on eBay and so on, but the bigger engines than these, the big Series 60 and 90s, which were 6 and 7 litre engines, very, very thirsty. But this one's 4.3, and it does. I can get about 15 to the gallon out of it, so it's not.
Tell us about this car specifically. Where did it come from? When did you get it? Did you have to restore it?
Yeah,
was it,
I bought
was it like this.
I bought it as a kid. I used to rally RAC 12 car with a mate, and we weren't very good and kept bending it. So we decided, let's see if we can find an old car to do up. So we paid £200 for this out of a barn. It was a complete shed, and then we realised.
Well, was
why.
It a shed or a barn? Make your mind up.
No, the car was a shed. It was in a barn.
The car was a shed, and it was in a barn. Very good.
It was a mess.
What would he... I mean, how old were you, Ian?
I was 21 when I bought it.
You were 21. When I was 21, I had Alfa Romeo GT V6 and a Yamaha 350 two-stroke. If I'd have seen an old motor like this, I wouldn't have given it the time of day.
I know.
Was it just because it was really cheap, you thought?
No, we really fancied doing something up, but we didn't realise what we were taking on. It was a massive challenge.
So your name is?
Gary Lucas.
Tell us about your car, Gary.
1970 Mercury Colony Park. I was very fortunate to get it. It was on American eBay, of all places. It had only been on about 6 hours, and I went back and it had sold. So I emailed the chap and said, if it falls through for any reason, just get back to me. And a week later, he got back to me, and we did the deal, and here it is.
I'm not being funny. But is it a massively collectible car in the States? You're saying after 6 hours it had already gone, somebody bought it.
Well, somebody bought it in Canada, and then he wanted to pay in instalments, apparently, but that was the problem, obviously.
I think we should describe the car a bit. I'm going to try and be kind. It's a station wagon, obviously.
Yeah.
It's got the... Is this actual... It can't... It's not actual
it's
wood,
called,
is it?
No, it's a Dynoc. It's like a vinyl wrap. So if you look on the edge of the doors, you'll see where it sort of overlaps the doors. And it's just a very good quality vinyl wrap. That's the difference.
It's got roof rails.
Roof rack, yeah.
And is this a 3 or a 4-way door?
It's a 2-way tailgate. So it's a tilt and turn tailgate. So it'll open that way and flat as well.
And the glass
and
goes
the glass
up and
goes
down
in the door, yeah. So it's the only electric window in the car in the back. And they call this rich yacht decking the wood effect in the brochure. Only the Americans, of course.
And here's the thing. It's massive. I mean, it's just a vast motor car. It's from a time when the American public bought their cars, like they bought their carpet, by the square yard.
Yeah.
This one is the biggest of the big. And I would imagine... Very expensive car to buy when it was new.
Oh yeah, when it was new. This was top of the range wagon as well. And the lady who bought it, she was a college lecturer, and in fact the sticker's still in the front window of her college pass when she had it new.
It looks very lightly used. You know, was it kind of? I mean, I've met a few. Oh, it's going to sound awful, but it's true. A few women who've driven massive cars.
Yeah.
And the reason, and I've thought, why does this, particularly an executive at the BBC, who drove this huge car? And she confessed to me once in the canteen over a cup of tea, she said, you know, the only reason I drive that massive car is because I'm a nervous driver. I'm convinced that at some point I'm going to have an accident. So I've gone out and bought the biggest car that I can, so that when this accident eventually happens, I'm as far away from it as possible.
That's true.
I mean, you could crash this thing and it'd be 5 minutes before you knew you'd been involved in some sort of RTA.
Yeah. What was that? Oh, it was a Mini, just bounced off the bonnet, yeah.
I mean, it, like I say, it's so lightly used. It was never used for what it was intended for, wasn't it? Which is lugging stuff around.
Exactly, and
she just drove it backwards and forwards
to work.
To work.
Yeah, that was it. I think definitely that was it. I don't think the back seat's ever been sat in. It's still got the original spare tyre, would you believe, in there, which is still full of air. It's a cross-ply.
Really?
45-year-old, yeah.
Please don't put it on the car.
No, I won't.
What colour is this?
So it's Oh, I forget the name of it, but it has actually got a light blue in it. It's got a very light blue touch in the paint. Yeah. So even though it looks white, when you see it in the sun, it does have like a blue tint. They do call it, I can't remember now, something blue. But I've not brought the original brochure with me because she optioned the twin front seats instead of the bench.
Right.
And the driver's seat's electric, and that all still works, forwards, backwards, up and down. It's unbelievable. 1970, you know, electric driver's seats.
Electric driver's seats in 1970. I think that's been today one of the things that's come, that's hit me hardest in terms of the difference between European cars and American cars. What we thought of as absolute, the very pinnacle of luxury, was kind of standard on American cars.
Absolutely.
You know, he, in the early 70s, my father would have had, what would he have had when this sort of period? He would have had a Hillman Minx, we had. A Hillman Minx. He's very popular. He loved the Roots group for some reason, my father. He had a Hillman Minx. Then we had a Chrysler Avenger. And then we had an Avenger Estate.
Oh, well, you were moving up in the world there.
Yeah, I mean, they were just... I mean, so technically, the Avenger Estate was meant to do the same job as this car. It was, you know, a load carrier, a workhorse. But there's just no comparison.
No.
There's just no comparison.
It's just phenomenal, isn't it? I mean, 2.5 tonne nearly, and still does 0-60 in 8.1 seconds.
Wow. Well, what's under the hood, as we should refer
to? A very small Ford 429 V8, which equates to 7.3 of our litres. And so that's why it picks it. And it's the four-valve engine in this one instead of the two-valve, which makes it breathe more, which produces something like 480 foot-pounds of torque.
It's so gloriously silly in some respects, isn't it? I mean, when we buy a car, when Brits buy a car like this, they're looking for something sensible. It's so that you can take the dogs out with you. When you've got this, where there should be a trunk, there's more load carrying space. It's because you want to put equipment in there. You go potholing, so you want to put your ropes and your bottles and all your stuff in there. Or you want to take, you've got three Irish setters and you want to take them to the park. When Americans buy a car like this, common sense just seems to fly out the window. It's like, what kind of engines do we have? Oh, an economical one. Don't be ridiculous. Let's have a massive V8 that does what to the gallon?
Well, 12.
12.
if you're gentle.
So where's the furthest that you'll take it on a run?
Well, this year, in fact, when we leave here at Tan Park, we're going on to Shrewsbury, and so this will be our biggest tour in this year. We'll probably do, you know, a total of maybe 300-400 miles, but that'll be its biggest tour of the year, sort of thing.
Right, well, it's about to absolutely chuck it down, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's getting very dark and grey.
Ashel, thank you for the interview. It's a fantastic car.
Thank you very much.
I would imagine incredibly rare now.
Well, at the moment, we think it's the only one in the UK. No one's got back to us. And even I've had Americans come up to me and say, wow, we don't even see these in the States anymore. So it must be getting rare over there as well.
And of course, the thing is,
please be careful with deck chairs, gazebos, etc. We don't want them blowing into people's cars.
If times
so if you're
get
away
hard,
from your car and you left your deck chairs there, or your gazebo, or your shelter, please just pop back and make sure it's secure. We don't want them blowing onto somebody's car. Thank you.
I was going to say.
This is Fat Radio International. Embrace the alternative.
This is Steve Speedshop in association with Douglas Loveridge Publications, The Enthusiast Bookshop. It's time for my favourite part of the show, and judging on the feedback from you, your favourite part as well, the greatest, in which we attempt to find the greatest motor car of all time. We do this by beginning with a very long shortlist of 99 motor cars. We take them three at a time. I have two expert guests in the studio with me. This week's those guests are Nigel Beck, who is a motorcycle racing champion, which he never forgets to remind me of.
Absolutely.
Wasn't your name on the same trophy as Carl Fogarty?
He was on the same as me.
He was on the same as you.
Yeah.
Right. And he is a car enthusiast, collector, restorer, and he is a bass player in probably the north of England's leading psych rock band. And Nick Coulton, who is a bon viveur, a motorcycling importer, retailer. And he's owned some very, very interesting cars, which he has restored, modified, and raced. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hi, Steve.
The three cars are... Well, here's the category, lads. And the category, now pay attention because it's a long one. Affordable four-seater performance cars, European... Sorry, I'll start again. affordable European four-seater performance cars of the mid to late 90s. Have we all got that?
Right, that would explain the grouping, yeah.
And the category... Well, basically, this is what I thought. If you were a chap, a man on the move, a man in a hurry, in sort of 96, 97, and you had about between 20 and 40,000 of Her Majesty's English pounds to spend on a motor car, but you find yourself in a position of requiring rear seats and nothing too exotic because you might have to use it for work purposes and the insurance on something more exotic may be unaffordable. And I thought, right, okay, what would those cars be? And the three cars that I came up with were the Lancia Delta Integrale, the iconic legend that is and was the Lancia Delta Integrale. And again, I may have kind of given some indication as to where my sympathies lie. The BMW E36 M3, the least loved of the M3s, although that still means it's pretty good. And the Fiat Coupe, Chris Bangle's radically styled Fiat Coupe, the one with the five-cylinder turbocharged engine. Nick, the Lancia Delta Integrale, why on earth wouldn't it absolutely romp home in this category in the same way that it romped home with six World Rally Championships?
Well, apart from the caveat that you were expressing, the person buying one of these cars might want to use it for mundane tasks like going to work or taking the kids to school, or, you know, just normal human being stuff, which I would imagine an Integrale would perform occasionally, but not all the time.
Well, I ran one as a family car, an 8-valve, an early 8-valve. It had gone pink already by the time all the red ones went pink. Somebody explained to me once, it's something to do with Beatles, the insects rather than the Volkswagens. And it was quite a practical car. I mean, it was based on a very humble family hatchback, wasn't it, Nigel?
Yeah, but you're very tolerant of these things, aren't you, Stephen? I mean, your idea of reliability, durability, they're slightly out of kilter with most people.
I used to live around the corner from Steve, and I tell you, it was like a bloody car park. Oh, yeah. Not everything used to run at any one time.
Well, you need five, because only one or two of them are running.
Absolutely right, yeah.
Well, the car was originated from 1979, Giugiaro design. I think it was European Car of the Year, which normally damns a vehicle, If a car's been voted European Car of the Year, it usually means that brown envelopes have changed hands. Yeah, it's a turkey, but here was the ugly duckling that turned into a beautiful swan, wasn't it, Nigel?
It was quite an attractive five-door hatchback that, when you applied martini stripes to it, became a thing of great beauty. And that is the only thing I would say for it. It needed martini stripes, or that was it.
Can't argue with that.
Well, they put a turbo on it. There was the HF turbo version. What do you mean, so what? That would have been enough for most people. But of course, the demise of Group... It was really the demise of Group B rallying that led to the road-going version of the turbo four-wheel drive car that we know and love, the Lancia Delta Integrale, in both its 8-valve, 16-valve, and then Evo 1. Some people say there was an Evo 2. I would take issue with that. I think there's no such thing as an Evo 2 Integrale, but there you go.
They were so tied in to the rallying scene, the Martini sponsorship, the contracts with the drivers, they had to do something because they couldn't use the 037s anymore because they changed the regulations. Hence, the Integrale was I wouldn't say cobbled together, but it was certainly...
Well, Group B rallying dropped at the end of the 86 season for all sorts of reasons that we haven't got time to go into here. But the HF four-wheel drive, not suited to Group A rallying, so the Delta HF Turbo became the top road car. But the Integrale, the 8-valve Integrale, some of the features of the Delta HF road car, but with an 8-valve, 2-litre fuel injection, 4-cylinder engine with balancing shafts, we're looking at the 8-valve, a Garrett T3 turbocharger with an intercooler, powered about, on a good day, about 200 brake horsepower, and permanent four-wheel drive, a front transversely mounted engine, 5-speed gearbox. None of this, a Ferguson viscous coupling, balanced the torque split between front and rear. None of this tells us why this was such an amazing car, not just in rallying, but on the road. I mean, one of the greatest driver's car of all time. Discuss.
Balance.
They were certainly, when they were enhanced, they were a great piece of kit. I think, especially the 8-valve as standard. Well, lackluster wouldn't be fair, but not the most invigorating thing to drive. But I think by the time they'd sorted them out in later models, they were a pretty impressive piece of kit. And if you play with them, a ludicrously impressive piece of kit.
Well, they were. And, of course, that Lampredi's twin cam, how old was that engine by the time it featured in the Integrale? The thing was 30 years old by the time it got there. And yet it could knock out 200 horsepower in standard trim. But I've driven versions of that car, insanely boosted versions of that car, where the things were cranking out, getting on for 500 brake horsepower.
And more. People have got far more than that.
But the thing is, Nick, actually holding together and being used without any sort of insane race-type maintenance regime. I mean, road cars, Integrale road cars with 500 brake horsepower. Amazing piece of kit.
But that's the case of the point of it being a 30-year-old engine. There was the concept of modern design is design everything to a limit, whereas there, we didn't know what the limit was. So we just made over-engineered things, which allowed headroom. They could boost and boost. I mean, probably I haven't seen one inside. The main bearing shells must be huge in that to be able to take it. I mean, but they didn't know any better.
But the thing is as well, permanent four-wheel drive, and a lot of people think, how can a car that has permanent four-wheel drive be a driver's car in the way that a rear-wheel drive car, as we're going to come on to in a second, might be? And again, I'm going to say that thing. Here we are, talking about cars on a radio show, expecting people to listen to it, what we're saying, and get some idea of what it's like to drive from that. But I am going to say that. You have to drive it. The way that the power was transmitted via that diff, that middle diff, and then distributed to either the front or rear wheels, mechanically as well, just gave that car a feel that I haven't had in any other car like it. Not in a Subaru Impreza, not in a Mitsubishi Evo, not in an Audi Quattro. They're all great in their own way, but there's something about the Lancia Delta Integrale that makes it a fantastically tactile car to drive. You really
do you feel it was superior to the Escort Cosworth or the, I don't know if you played with one, a Nissan Pulsar GTIR, stuff like that. I mean, they're all very similar setups and end results, really, aren't they?
Yeah, the Escort, Nick, is a car that I have driven, and I think, in the right circumstances, quicker than an Integrale, which these days does feel old. Does feel very much a classic. It's a classic now. It is. It's passed into classic status. It makes me feel very old to think that, but it has. I'm not saying that the Integrale is necessarily the quickest car from A to B. It'd certainly be embarrassed by a lot of modern performance cars. But I wonder if you'd enjoy it quite as much as you would in the Lancia. There's something. I mean, I've driven a Stratos and I didn't enjoy it. There's a controversial statement. Driven the Lancia Stratos, an iconic car.
I've not read anybody that's ever driven one that said they was nice to drive.
Well, they were fast.
You're sitting sideways to start with. And you couldn't see out of them.
No, but and they're uncomfortable, and there's that weird skewed driving position. They're wonderful to look at. They're utterly gorgeous motor car from any angle. I'm such a massive, massive Bertone fan. It's ridiculous. But a Lancia Delta Integrale is the car that I was talking about at the start here. It is an affordable, usable, reliable, believe it or not, yes, it's Italian, but reliable car. The interior is hilariously dated.
It's not good, is it?
I mean, no. if I look back at some of the outfits that I used to step out in, and you as well, both of you, in fact, in the 80s, double or triple the embarrassment of the stuff. I mean, it's a riot of 80s stripes and clashing colours. It's like being inside a Howard Jones video, being inside a Lancia Delta Integrale. It's that 80s.
And how did you manage to pluck Howard Jones was the first thing that came to
mind?
I just thought of something. What is the epitome of 80s bad taste, which at the time we thought was a good idea? And it was a toss-up between Flock of Seagulls, Nick Kershaw and Howard Jones. There you go. Let's talk now for a moment about a BMW M3. And everybody's thinking, oh, fantastic, the fabulous, legendary BMW M3. Surely a worthy competitor for your hard-earned with the Lancia. But, gentlemen, it's the E36, the least-loved Nigel of all the M3s.
And the best-looking by miles.
How can you say that, man?
I'll tell you why I can say that. Well, as you know, I owned one for 10 years. I've only just parted with it. But the fact is, it's the prettiest 3 Series of them all. It's beautifully understated. It's got the big wheels, it's got the right suspension, and everything is nicely boxed away. And, all right, the wing mirrors, the body kit that's on it is subtle. You know it's an M3, it's lowered. I know your argument's going to be, it looks like a 328i. So what? A 335 looks like an M3. And all this business about bulking them up with big arches, I liken it to Arnold Schwarzenegger and Bruce Lee.
Ah. Right?
Now.
Yes.
Arnold Schwarzenegger is a big, huge, muscle-bound, bulging everywhere person.
You're going to say, in a fight,
Bruce Lee,
every time.
You've seen the picture. He's ripped. He's there. He's lean. Yeah. He's mean. And that is what the E36, plus it's the prettiest thing. The interior is lovely. They go really, really well. And you can buy them for, I just sold the most beautiful one in the world, genuinely, for under 4,000
quid. Well, there you
quid.
Go. Damned by its own success, Nick, yeah?
Not really got any strong opinions, to be brutally frank. I know that's not very helpful when you consider the criteria of the discussion and the programme. If we're talking about the reasons of, you know, the thoughts behind the putting these three cars together, then I think if you were, is the one you go for, if you wanted to use it day to day, you know, performance four seat, practical saloon car.
And a very fast car, Nick. I mean, they're ridiculous.
Yes, hold on. Let me just give the caveat to that. In my research, there were lots of very nice things said about the E36 M3 by European journalists and commentators at the time. The Americans not quite so keen, but of course our version had 300 horsepower. North Americans got 230,
and then it went to 321 with the 3.2, the later model.
Debuted in 92, the E36 M3, first M3 powered by a straight six engine, 300 horsepower in Europe, 240 in the States. They did build a lightweight Evo version. Nick, you'll be able to explain this. What's this thing about Canada, where Canada gets the most powerful version of whatever performance machine is available? Canada got a special M3 that was more powerful than anybody else.
Like, I can only assume the Americans got such a low power one because of emission criteria, and I presume Canada at that point in time didn't really care and didn't have any emission controls whatsoever.
Well, is it just a backdoor thing to get them into the States, Nick? That's what I'm saying.
There's always been an agreement. I mean, the cars that if they do cross the border have to correspond to, you know, each country's regulations, both emission and crash testing, etc. And most North American vehicles pass across the border quite easily, but imports don't always. And I would imagine that, like I say, the reason for the low-power American one must have been due to federal regulations, and therefore just pitching up with a Canadian one and trying to get titled in the US, I don't think would have been an easy thing. Mm. I just think the laxer the situation was, the more power you got.
This was an amazing sales success for BMW. They sold loads and loads and loads of them. One of the reasons they sold loads of them, I'm sure you remember this, Nigel, for 3 years of its production, there wasn't an M5. The E34 M5 disappeared and there wasn't another M5 for 3 years. So if you wanted a rear-drive, full-sized-ish motor car with four doors, and for that reason there was a saloon version because there was no M5 at the time, then the E36 M3 was the only... What was competing with it? No. What was competing with it
Nothing.
At the time?
I mean, I bought it because I needed the four seats. I had an S2000 at the time. And
you got the convertible, though.
I did have a factory hardtop
as
Nigel,
well. Yeah, but Nigel, I know you.
Great car.
You're not a drug dealer. So why did, why
it
did
had,
you...
It was mentioned I was the only person in Bury that had one that wasn't. And it was purple as well. So
I think it was purple. You had the purple one.
Yeah, the light purple one. It was,
Do you know, there was...
Pimp my ride, mate.
Right,
beautiful.
I was looking at... you had the purple one. I was looking at a price guide to these cars. There's a bit of research.
Estoril blue.
And the purple one, there's actually a deduction on the... It's the only one that in the guide there's a deduction for if it's the purple.
No, there's two purples. Mine was the light one.
Oh, right.
Which
light.
Was a special colour.
The pinky purple.
Yeah, that's the one, yeah. Oh, beautiful. I had a Jensen Ealy in the same colour, and I just couldn't help myself. When
Why
I saw
can
it.
You buy a really good one for £5,000? That's
it's
insane.
Beyond me.
A
it's
300
beyond me.
Brake horsepower.
Beyond me.
Rear wheel drive, driver's car, which at the time, whether it was performance car, I remember back in the great days of performance car, possibly the most influential car magazine there's ever been, with John Barker and Brett Fraser and Richard Meaden and Jeremy Clarkson, lest we forget. They used to rave about the E36 M3. Absolutely rave about it. It was their benchmark car. If a new performance car came out, they'd track test it against the E36 M3.
I bought mine 4 years old. It was £45,000 new. I bought it for £12,995 with about 25,000 miles on the clock. It's a ridiculous.
What about the experience of owning one, Nigel? Was it the cheapest car I've ever owned? The cheapest car you've ever owned?
Yeah, absolutely.
Liar. The servicing must have been brutal.
No, not at all.
No?
Seriously, wasn't.
And practical? A decent-sized boot? Wear and tear on the interior? Wore well?
Yeah. It was
It held together?
It's not very sexy stuff, this, Steve, is it?
I didn't say
I'm not getting very enthused about this, to be honest with you. I was disinterested when we started. I'm even more so now.
And to be honest, Nick, this is what I was going to come to now. And I had it for 10 years, and I probably only did about 20,000 miles in it. I've had a 911 for a year and a half, and I've done 12,000 miles. So that tells you something.
It tells a story, doesn't
it? It is a beautiful thing. And if somebody wanted something to put in a garage on bricks and bring it out in 20 years' time and make a few quid, buy one. They're great. They cost nothing to run. There's plenty of parts. Parts are not that expensive. It's a pretty thing, but yeah. Does it get you excited?
I'll tell you what gets me excited. A car that I've just bought, the Fiat Coupe 20-valve turbo produced by Italian manufacturer Fiat between 1993 and 2000.
Do our American listeners know what it's all going to
tell you what. They see you coming, Steve, don't they? They really do.
It is most remembered for its distinctive angular design by Chris Bangle.
And Lego.
Chris Bangle, then, of course...
Remembered as opposed to admired, Lego, didn't
he? Didn't he get death threats at BMW because of what he did there? I like it. I think it's an amazing-looking car. It debuted with two engines, a four-cylinder... 2 litre 16 valve engine, turboed and naturally.
When you said two engines, I thought you meant it came with a spare one in the boot.
if you've ever driven one, Nick, it could do with something in the boot.
Well, it is a Fiat and it is front wheel drive, and so I know for a fact, Nick Coulter, that you have automatically discounted this car.
Well, I won't discount it entirely because I have owned two front wheel drive cars in my life. One was an 850 minivan.
Yep.
And one was a 500 cubic inch or an 8.2 litre Cadillac Eldorado.
Ooh.
They were both without merit. and I'll never own a front wheel drive car again.
Yeah, fair point.
Yes, but there's a very clever viscous coupling, limited slip.
Yes, they all say that, viscous coupling. Yes, but it doesn't make the power go to the correct end of the car, Stephen. How many couplings you put in it?
Right, do you know why I wanted one of these? Two reasons, because I like the look of it.
Because it was £9.
Well, I'll tell you, shall I be honest with you?
Go on.
It's just over £600 to buy one.
Yeah.
And it's not in the... Best...
I mean, the market just generally decides these values due to the merits of the car, Steve.
No, they do not. No, this is my point. It was, if you remember, it was an incredibly successful car at the time for Fiat.
It was, yeah.
They made 75,000. It seems that they sold most of them. In total, this is Fiat made 75,000 from 93 to 2000. It seems to sell most of them in the UK. They were very noticeable. It was a very distinctive car. Yellow. It made Chris Bangle's name. BMW hired him to restyle the fives, and then let him go.
And sevens.
Yeah, pear-shaped is still the phrase that comes to mind.
The 2 litre 5-cylinder 20 valve, which is the one that I've got a vet for £600. Got a variable inlet system, which brought the power up to 154 brake horsepower. But the 2 litre 5-cylinder turbo, sorry, made a mistake there. I've not got the naturally aspirated. I bought the turbo, and yes, it does smoke. Received a 6-speed gearbox in 1998. When performance car, I'll mention performance car again. When they track tested this car at their Car of the Year track session, where they have all the most fantastic performance cars that have been released that year. When they track tested it, it finished
at £23,000 brand new, it finished higher than cars, costing two and three times as much. And I'll never forget this because it was my pal Anthony Reid who was driving it. It was a second off the track, off the lap time of the Nissan touring car. The Nissan British touring car of that era, a standard
brown envelope drive car.
I'm just saying is this. Right.
All right, where was it in the total scheme of things?
You know, the brown envelope thing from the European Car of the Year might.
If it came last and the Nissan Touring Car came second to last, that's not exactly a recommendation, Stephen.
It looks distinctive. Fiat,
I get that.
Fiat
yes.
have a great sporting history. We talk from the very first days of motorsport. Fiat have been there. We talked about the Lancia's rallying heritage. What about Fiat's rallying heritage? A Bath. You know, it's a great name. It's a great badge. And the problem with you two is you're both massive snobs and you're biased against it because it comes from a humble manufacturer.
It's a drive. Not the badge on the front of it, although it is Fiat. You know, we can live with it. The power goes to the wrong end of the car. Ergo, not interested.
I actually went to buy one of these. I'm going to hold my hands up here. Richard Courts in Bury.
Yes, from the Fiat dealership in North Manchester.
Yeah. That's him. And I went down there thinking I needed...
What colour did you want?
Oh, God, yellow, of course.
Yellow?
Yeah.
Broom yellow. I don't know why they call it broom yellow. I've never seen a yellow broom. But
I took it round some near roads. You will be familiar with them, around the Pillsworth area. And having decided that I really didn't want to spend my life pulling the thing out of hedges... I took it back to him, shook his hand and said, not for me, thank you.
They're lively.
Lively? Lively? No.
I'll give you that. Right, gentlemen, enough of this.
I bought an Alfa instead.
What did you buy? A
155
twin spike.
Proper car.
Maybe we should have included...
That was front-wheel drive and that was excellent.
Maybe we
Can
should
I go have... now?
In just one second, what you've told us... from these three cars, and I will re-emphasise the category that we've been pointlessly bickering about, I have to be honest today, because I know exactly
more
where...
More pointless than normal
We haven't had a category where there's been a clearer winner. I don't think... Even when we talked about the 356 Porsche, which everyone's completely in love with, and all true... enthusiasts. You don't like the 356? Right, well, let's not go there.
TR2 was the car.
Let's not go there at the moment. Which was the greatest affordable four-seater European performance car of the mid to late 90s?
Nicholas, yes, what Cosworth? You didn't ask about that.
Yeah,
Nicholas Coulter. Was it the Fiat Coupe 20-valve turbo? Was it the BMW E36 M3, or was it the iconic legend that is and was the Lancia Delta Integrale?
Unsurprisingly, it's not the Fiat. moving swiftly on, difficult one. If you're talking about what I'd like to own, it'd probably be the Integrale. If your heart was ruling your head, but I think in the three, it's got to be the Fiat, the Lancia Integrale, and just behind the BMW M3, because it's a car that, like you said, had an impact. It fulfilled the criteria of the discussion, and at the end of the day, it's what I'd end up buying if I had to choose between the three.
Mm. This is going to be interesting because Nigel is hugely in love with the E36 M3, despite its unremarkable appearance and it's the fact that it's common and seems to have been taken on board very much by the drifting community, which in certain circles, but not in these, has devalued its currency. So come on, Nigel, call it 3-2-1.
Right, it's not the Fiat.
This is terrible.
Mate. I quite like them, and I like to look at them, but I would certainly not own one, having tried that. I love the BMW, and bearing in mind the M3 as a brand is the only car ever to win more races than the Porsche 911, and that is one hell of a record.
Mm.
However, having owned for 10 years, loved it, beautiful. It's a toughie. I'm gonna have to say if you said you could drive one home now, I'm going to drive an Integrale home.
Mm.
And then I'm going to sell it and buy two M3s.
Ah, very good. Good answer. Well, having bought a Fiat Coupe 20-valve turbo in that dark green, I think it's called forest green.
We've just knocked about 50% of its value off there, Steve. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Nick. I don't care. I'm going to keep it. I think they're going to be recognised as a
absolute 18-carat classic in the very near future.
As indeed,
how many thousands did they sell over here?
As indeed Austin Maestro's now
did
are.
You,
so.
Did you say broom? Did you say broom yellow, Stephen?
Dark green. I think it's called forest green.
No, but what was the colour? The yellow.
Broom yellow.
It was called broom yellow.
Yeah.
And you said never seen it. It wasn't the broom. It was a broom to sweep the rust up.
Yeah. Right. I'll start again. In third place, the Fiat. In second place, the Lancia. Yeah, the Lancia. Yes, they won 6 World Rally Championships. Yes, it's a great-looking car. I loved certain things about the 8-valve one that I owned, but it was a poorly made motor car. By the time they finished making it, it was well made. But
that was Friday, wasn't it?
Yeah, the early ones. I mean, it just fell in bits. It just crumbled in my ownership. The E36 M3 BMW, the first one with a straight six engine. We had 300 horsepower out of the box here in Europe and in the UK, particularly. It was a car. It's a car that, in some ways, was a victim of its success. They sold so many of them that it became incredibly cheap to acquire used and fell into the hands of all sorts of Herberts, younger versions of ourselves, who used and abused it, and, you know, it would feature regularly on Crime Watch. I will say
the insurance on him is, in my period of ownership, was absolutely outrageous.
Yeah.
Absolutely outrageous. Because
they were always being stolen, and criminals used them to try and outrun the law.
And when I sold
That's why, Nigel, there's not a big mystery. when you sold
it. A Porsche 911 cut with a value of 6-7 times cost a third of the price to insure. But that tells you a story.
You can't get a 55-inch flat screen in the back of a BMW 911.
Yes, very, very true, that was Nicholas. You're right.
So, there we are. That's what I think. I put the car that I've just bought, the Fiat, in third. The Lancia Delta Integrale in second. Even though, when I had one, I was working regularly for Auto Italia magazine and would often drive it to the location of a photo shoot with a very, very much more expensive and much, much more powerful Italian exotic. And the Lancia was frequently quicker on any given road section than the
A to B.
Ferrari, Lamborghini, Maserati, whatever it was. But if we're talking the best affordable four-seater European performance car of the mid/late 90s, it has to be, for me, the BMW E36 M3. But it's not up to me, it's up to, or indeed to these two, who I thank for being my guests this week.
Well, the first team, the first time we've agreed on the three cars. So
yeah, it is
the first time.
It is, yeah.
Wow, the first time we've all agreed. So let's see what you think. Go to our Facebook page, which you'll find at Steve's Speed Shop on Facebook. We're not the guys in Atlanta who will sell you a massive turbo for your drag car. We're the guys in England who bicker about motor cars.
Across the world, 24 hours a day. This is Fab Radio International.
That's it for another Speed Shop. My thanks to my guest Nick Coulton and Nigel Beck. We'll be back here on Fab Radio International next week from 7 o'clock. Don't forget to vote for the greatest, which was the greatest European four-seater performance car of the mid to late 90s. Was it the BMW M3? Was it the Lancia Delta Integrale? Or was it the Fiat, the one that I've just bought, the Fiat Coupe 20 valve turbo? Vote on our Facebook page. You'll find us at Steve's Speed Shop.